Accession number 8834, rule number 6.
Mr. Northcote, tape 6. Were you given any recognition for your
sniping?
Well,
I was told that I was to be... They would mention me in dispatches.
And were you? Yeah.
No, never.
Why was that, do you think?
No, well, because they were both killed, right?
When
before
were they...
They'd no chance to get... That's trivial compared to what was going on. I mean, if they had any time to spare, they'd do it. I suppose they never had a chance. Because
they,
I understand
you think
they were both killed a week later.
What were the relations like between the officers and men?
Oh, very good.
Were they?
Very good. Well, we were not. It wasn't like the regular army. You see, some of our privates were better off than the officers. There's a firm called Kendall Milnes in Manchester, still bears that name. And it was taken over by Harrods. It was the premier shop in Manchester, in Deansgate. And I don't know where I've got to in there. Alec Milne, one of the son, a great big chap, about 6'4", he was on that Guard of Honour. And a rugby player, played for Manchester. And... He was studying for the bar, a private.
That's the sort of person you had, was it?
So, yeah. Not all. Don't say all. He was outstanding, of course, a university man, and but he was killed on the 4th of June. He got a commission before, very unusual in our battalion. And nobody would rent that at all. He was a very fine man.
Anything else you can tell me about your period up at the front during this 3-week period? Anything else that happened that you think might be of
interest? Well, the thing before I was wounded, when it became dark, we were lay down on the parapet on your side. And the one my brother was doing one end, I know, and I think the sergeant or somebody at the other end, and they rolled you over into no man's land, and then passed over your rifle and your spade or your pickaxe, whatever it was, and you worked in pairs to build a new firing line 100 yards in front of the old line, because they were preparing for the attack on the 4th of June. And the communication trenches, 2 communication trenches. We were working on that all night. We thought we'd be shot to pieces. And transpired the next day, they knew what we were doing. And they were putting up barbed wire entanglements. Spent the night doing that. Well, I came out the next morning and...
Before you tell me about that, this digging of trenches in the night, was it very difficult work?
Oh,
did you have to be very
quiet? Couldn't see a thing. And what you were given, as well as your rifle, you were passed over a full sandbag and an empty one. And your instructions were to crawl out to where your allotted place was, put the sandbag in front of your head, and get on the job with your entrenching tool, something smaller, you see, until you could get down a bit, and then... One of you would use the pick and the other one would shovel the stuff out. And you did that if you're on a communication trench, it's a zigzag like that, you see. And where the zigzag faced the wall, faced the enemy, that's where you put your earth. Didn't matter about the other side because it wasn't exposed. In the front, of course, it all went out in the front line. It all went out into the front to make the parapet.
Was that a very unpleasant job to do?
No, not really. I mean, you couldn't couldn't see them. We were wondering what the devil was going to happen next. But it didn't happen. They didn't fire because they were busy doing the barbed wire.
Did you feel very frightened there at this time? Were you very frightened?
No, never. That's a funny thing. I'm not saying this in any sense of boast. I never was. I can't tell you. The only thing I can think was, I knew I could shoot as well as they can, and probably a jolly sight better. I don't know why, but it seemed to be.
It gave you confidence.
I've had very, very near misses. I mean, by your head when we were sniping. You hear the thing going by. But you're lucky, you see. You're either lucky or unlucky. Now, why we were certain this man had a telescopic sight, it picked off two of our lieutenants, both very tall men. One was Lieutenant Killock and the other one was Compton Smith. Both 6 footers. Killock was about 6'2". And I think they did it in a sense of not to show fear to the rank and file, walking upright down the trench. Bang, right through the head. Well, you can't do that without the telescopic sight. Two of them. And, of course, once that happened, we were on the job with letting them have it back. That was our mission in life. Then another one was our senior captain was Basley, and he was a shooting man. He was a member of our, we had a diddle rifle club, you know, before the war, and he was one of the members of the club. Very nice dude. We used to have ham and eggs afterwards, cooked by the warden's wife, the range warden's wife. Oh, really lovely dudes there. Anyway, Basley had found that behind where we were sniping there was a rise in the ground. I don't know, I think it was a latrine actually. That was just a big hole dug out. He went off and just squatted down. No, nothing to sit on or anything like that. And shovel some earth over. And he was, I think he was on the top of that bank, and he was watching us sniping. He had his field glasses, and our lieutenant was Brooke Taylor. He was very keen on me because of the shooting. He told me, he said, I know that I want you to come with me. There's going to be a big attack. He said, I want you to come with me, Northcote, because I've seen a machine gun. I'm going to capture it. Well, the most daft thing in your life is to go head on to capture a machine gun. You inflate a machine gun. You don't go head on for it. You're bound to get peppered. Well, you are, he's killed. Well, he came in with he borrowed a rifle from one of the men and was going to start sniping with us. Well, he hadn't got a clue. An ordinary sight. And he was moving about a lot, which you daren't do. You had to keep perfectly still, you know. Load your rifle almost without moving. And Basley was watching through his glasses. Brooke Taylor, stop moving about. You're giving the position away. And he cleared off. And just after that, he was using these field glasses, and of course they're glinting in the sun. Bang, right through the head. He'd killed out right. Fine chap, dear. He was a senior captain.
You were saying when you went over this night to extend your front line, you know, to take it forward that night,
yes.
The Turks were then moving their barbed wire.
They were erecting new barbed wire.
Yes. Was there
they
much
knew what
barbed
was coming. They knew there was a big attack
mm.
coming.
Had they had barbed wire there before? But would it have been further back?
Well, probably their positions were... They may have had some, but they really went to town. And they told me afterwards it was a terrible job of getting over that barbed wire, getting through it. The gunfire had smashed up a lot of it. Preliminarily, put a lot of gunfire up before an attack, of course, both from the Navy and our field guns. But the one thing I must mention about those guns, one of the greatest thing that was lacking on Gallipoli was the absence of mortars. with no proper mortars. No, when I say mortars, I'm wrong. Howitzers. Howitzer fires its shell up high and it drops almost vertically. Far better than field guns for doing damage, and of course bigger shells, 6 inches and 9 inch mortar howitzers, and they hadn't any, as far as I know, not in my time.
And that was
the Turks. I tell you one thing, rather interesting. On the Asian side of the strait, where Troy is, they had a gun on rails, on a gun carriage, a big gun. It was about 6 inches, I think, naval gun. And that we it was christened Asiatic Annie by us. And it had an engine on the front. It used to come out, fire about half a dozen rounds or so, back into either a tunnel or a cutting. And they never got it. At least not in my time.
And did that do much damage, do you think? Asiatic? Did it do much damage, Asiatic?
Well,
Army?
They were firing on chance, really. You couldn't do anything. But then the area of land is so small. This is 3 miles inland, 3 miles probably across the front, not more. A veil, that's not very much space. You only got to fire a few shells in there. Something's got to go, sometime or other.
How about the British Navy and the firing of their guns? Did they have any effect?
Not the right type.
But
they're
did they?
Right, they're all right for bashing other big battleships and shore batteries and things like that, but not for trench work. The trajectory is too low, you see. They've got like that. Down.
Yes, it was the howitzers, as you
like
say.
Bang, into the trench. And blows everything to smithereens, yeah.
But
and when they hit the ground, those big shells, they don't just drop there, they skid on the land, according to what the land's like, for the burst.
But did the Navy put up much guns?
Oh, yes, fair play, yes. But it's not the gunfire that really was wanted. To my way of thinking, I'm no expert, but I've got a fair idea.
This attack you were saying, Mr. Northcote, you were preparing for by forwarding the front
line. 100 yards. It means there's 100 yards less to fire to go through.
Did you actually participate in that?
No, I was wounded the next morning.
Oh, I wonder if now you would tell us the story of what happened
morning.
When
I came back into the trench, it was still dark. I had to come out before it got light, of course. And my brother was there, because I was always mugging. So he didn't... that's probably the wrong word. I'm forgetting I'm doing. I think I'm talking to you privately. Tom, go back to the trench, the old firing line, and drop your stuff, drop your kit, and come back with Grimmy, my friend, the sniping pal, and we've got some rations, something we'd never seen before, McConaughey rations in tins. I didn't know this at the time. I had a sandbag half full of that and half full of onions, and the other sandbag was full of all things white bread. Anyway, we decided it was, with all the equipment on, best to go down to the gully, down into the gully, which was about 30 feet deep, the big gully, and come up at the other end through the trench. We did this, put our kit down. I'd forgotten to tell you, the trench had broken away and water had been heavy rain days before, and mud about that deep. We didn't want to go through that. So we went out, it was still dark, you see, back into the trench again, and then carried on, put our kit down where we were supposed to do. said, well, it's not very light. Come on, let's. And we ran back across No Man's Land, which is now No Man's Land, to the old front line again. We're in the reserve line here, back to the old front line where my brother was, you see. And he got those rations, you see. And I got. We both had a bag on each shoulder and decided with that weight on, getting a bit lighter, back through the gully again. Came back through the gully, and the 8th Manchester's in the line next to us, and Grimshaw stopped to speak to a sergeant, a friend of his. I said, oh, I'll carry on, Percy's name, I'll carry on, Percy. And I got out of the trench again to go around this mud. Bang. I was sideways on, you see, to the, and it hit me there.
In your, just that's in your the, bottom, really, bottom, isn't it?
Bottom of the cheek.
Yeah.
I'm down, lucky not to. Well, I don't know how the devil I wasn't killed. And if it had hit the hip joint, I'd have lost everything, leg and everything. But it, I think I was hit by an explosive bullet myself, because I had one piece taken out in Malta. I had a big boil came up on my leg. That's the leg was up on an extension, trying to pull it out, get the length back. And I had the other piece taken out 2 months later in Manchester. I had an operation there, and they took a whole lot of the callus out, and plus the point of the bullet, which was all bent over. But where the lead from the bottom half had gone, I had two holes in the front of my leg, and they thought that was the wound. They didn't know it was broken. I did, because when I fell back like that with the sacks, and when I looked down, my leg wasn't there. It was across here, and the foot was turned the other way around. So I sat up and straightened it so, and two or three fellas pulled me into the trench, dragged me off. I wonder they didn't open fire, and then they didn't. And Grimshaw was put me on a stretcher and cut my trousers down. It's not nothing much there, because I couldn't see the one that was on me, and they bound it up and started to carry me back to the dressing station, which was in a big hole about half the size of this room, dug into the ground, and the Turk opened fire on me, I think with a machine gun, and they dropped the stretcher and me, dropped themselves, waited a bit, they stopped, and they got up again, and we walked on. And I've always liked to think that the Turk realised it was a stretcher, and they didn't open fire. Not the second time. I got into the back trench, and of course our own doctor, Captain Norris, was our medical officer, and he said, "You're all right." He knew me, of course. But I was very well known. "Is he all right, Northcote?" I said, "Yes," and he never bothered to look at me. Somebody said, "Oh, it's only a flesh wound, it's in his two holes."
And the bullet was actually hidden below, was it?
It was inside, in two pieces. And some of the lead had come through the front, I think.
Were you in great pain?
I suppose I was in a way, but I didn't bother about it very much.
How about loss of blood? Were you bleeding?
No. Funny thing, no. Very little blood came out. For some reason, I don't know why, the hole seemed to close over a certain amount. And, it was a very, very old stretch, and the canvas was touching the ground. I thought, I can't stand that. As they turned me over on my side, they thought I was making a lot of fuss about it. I wasn't at all. As I turned it on the side, and then this leg, I couldn't. There was nothing, no feeling there at all, of course, from there down. And the thing kept on slipping off. I had no control over it. I couldn't do anything. I said, "Oh, take the putty." I was giving them all the instructions. I said, "Take my putty off and tie the two legs together. Tie it on top of the other, on the side like that." You see. As I tied the two legs together. And away they went. They took me down to the stretcher bearer's place, and they were moaning about 6 o'clock in the morning. You know, you shouldn't be wounded. Anyway, they were all right. And they had to carry me. It's a long trail, about a mile and a half on a stretch, a long way. And then there was like the old ambulance they had in the Boer War, canvas top, four wheel, two horses. And I was put on the floor of this thing, over rough ground. Imagine what it was like. With a damn stretcher touching the floor, the canvas touching the floor. Anyway, I got down to the dressing station. It was a sergeant, R.A.M. proper pucker, R.A.M.C.
What beach
sergeant.
Was that on, the dressing station? What beach would that have been on? Would that
the
have been
one I told you about, where my cousin was.
The V Beach.
V Beach. Mm. And she has a good memory. And he said, would the BH put you on a stretcher like this with a compound fractured femur? I didn't know what a femur was. Anyway, he transferred me to another stretcher and put a fresh dressing on it because he found where the wound was. Practically no loss of blood. Very little.
Did he then realise that you had a wound other than the fracture at that stage, that you had this bullet
yes,
in
he
there?
Knew. Yes. Oh, yes, he was a qualified, very, very, very efficient. Mm. But our own doctor never bothered me. He just said, you're all right, Northcote. I said, yes, thanks.
What did they give you for the pain? Did
nothing.
They give you anything
to
do?
Nothing like that. I was taken from there into a marquee. There's a Red Cross flag on the pole outside. That was the medical place. A couple of big marquees there, white marquees. They weren't supposed to fire on those. And I was on the ground, on the grass, the stretcher on the grass. And a fellow came up. He said, with two army biscuits with a slice of bully in between. And a strong mug of sweet tea. Well, that's grand. I had that lot. And just on that, a padre came in, an old boy with a white moustache, dear old chap. And the medical sergeant had tied a label on, a green label, for England, to be sent to England. Because it was a severe wound, you see. I didn't realise it at the time. I thought I'd show my back, broken leg, that's nothing. And anyway, he said, oh, you're all right, my boy. He said, you're labelled for England. Oh, so I went, and then I was carried down to V Beach. We were taken out on the lighters, and I was put on this HMS Reindeer. And I was on the poop deck with about five other stretchers, and the bloke opened up. It was about 50 miles to Lemnos in this ship. It was a very fast little ship. Anyway, heaps of wounded, of course, and standing cases and walking cases, or whatever they call them. And he suddenly opened up this smelling gun, falling around the stretcher. That the submarine that had sunk, he sank the Majestic on the 27th, the day before I was wounded, just off Cape Ellis. And she sank the Triumph on the 25th off the Anzac positions. Both ships. Damn fine naval officer, German. He's on his own. No other ship. Come through the... Yeah, I think he'd come through the... Because they could let him through the minefields and that. He'd be submerged. I think he'd come through from the Black Sea. I don't know. He may not. He may have come through the med. I don't know.
But he was now having
a go at
you. He did
some damage, I tell you. My God, he did. Mm-hmm. And he was after us. Because we were steaming ahead. We were quite a bit ahead. And the gun firing at him, he spotted the periscope. His periscope out of the water. But the submarine itself submerged. And he didn't hit him. Anyway, didn't get him. Because he sank some more ships after that.
Did the Navy treat you well on this boat?
Oh, marvellous. Oh, this sailor came to me and he said, anything I can do for you, Sonny? Gave me lit a cigarette, gave me a handful, and I said, well, the one thing you can do, I've still got my boot on. Let's take my boot off. See, he didn't bother to untie it. Jack now cut the laces, eased it off.
Did you have any other attention on that ship? Was there a doctor on board who came to see you?
No, not until when we got there. We found the hospital, proper hospital ship had gone. And one of our ships was in our convoy going out to Egypt. A ship called the Neuralia. We christened her the Neuralgia. And she'd been hastily converted into a hospital ship. We were lying on the mess table, the wooden mess table. They had a mattress, granted that, and they moved them round. They were side by side, two tables side by side, so side by side. And a lifeboat under the pillow, what use that would have been. They drowned like rats. I couldn't move. Now, very few others could. We were all cock cases. And I couldn't raise myself. I couldn't get on a bed. I couldn't go to the lavatory for 8 days. Didn't matter very much because I didn't eat anything. Just a bit of bread and butter. The only thing I had was any drinks. I was all right with the water bottle.
Were you in pain?
I suppose it must have been to some extent. It didn't worry me very much. I tell you, the thing is this. There's so many other poor devils with terrible head wounds and stomach wounds and chest wounds. You thought, God, what have you got to worry about? That's the attitude to take and the attitude you do take, if you've got any sense.
Were there some awful cases?
Oh, well, a man next to me, the bullet had gone in there, in his right eye, clean through the eye, and come out just above his other eye. Stop staring mad. Wasn't a fatal wound. And I found out afterwards, I saw this chap when I was in Malta. He was about 4 beds down, with both eyes bandaged up, he was totally blind, shouting out for rice pudding. Give me some rice pudding. But he was swearing and carrying on. You're sitting on the...